That was awful.
That was awesome.
How can you say that? Your pet went berserk at doggy boot camp today.
I know. That's exactly what I was hoping you would do.
Rashy, he was attacking everything in sight. The other dogs, passersby.
Oh, hey, he's got something in his mouth. What do you have, Homer?
I think it's the hand of the trainer.
Well, I can probably reattach it.
Oh, boy.
Hi, this is Paul Dini.
Hey, this is Misty Lee. How are you guys doing?
We're doing okay today. It was kind of a weird day today.
Yeah, I mean, it was. We just attended Earl Kress's memorial service, which was beautiful, and I have to say, the funniest memorial service, and appropriately so, that I have ever attended. I was complimenting Mark Evanier, whom, as most of you know, has been a guest on here, and we need to have him back.
Definitely.
Because he was such a delicious and entertaining guest. Yeah. But I complimented him after and said, I have never heard applause after a speech at a memorial service, and it was so appropriate. It was so beautiful, and it was so written with Earl in mind. It was warm,
thoughtful,
and loving, and it was really, really touching.
Yeah, it was very much, the memorial was very much in the spirit of Earl himself.
Mm-hmm.
If you're listening to this and you don't know who Earl Kress is, that's a possibility. But you undoubtedly, in fact, know some of his work. Earl was a many, many things. He was a performer. He was a voiceover artist.
He was a voiceover artist who studied under Dawes Butler.
He was a puppeteer who worked with Jim Henson.
And played Ernie in the final scene.
Of the Muppet movie.
Mm-hmm.
And
while Jim was operating Kermit, Ernie was being operated by Earl. He also worked on the story team for The Fox and the Hound, the Disney feature.
Great.
He has
a nice
credit on there. And wrote many, many cartoons. And he was, in fact, one of the very first cartoon professionals I met in the business when I started, way back in 1980, he had gotten a starter job at Filmation Studios, where I was working, actually. And I had been working there as sort of like a junior writer, kind of, you know, guy just learning the business. And I had done a couple of sketches and stories that had gotten me a job at Filmation and was writing my first scripts. And then I meet this guy, Earl Kress. And I had been so used to Earl's appearance over the last 25 years or so, I'd forgotten what he looked like 30 years ago until somebody mentioned it, because he was kind of this hippie. He had kind of curly, kinky hair and a beard and everything, and that's how I remember him, and that's how I met him. And we didn't work together much, because it was kind of weird at the time. Back in around 1980, animation writing was very seasonal. It tended to kick into high gear around spring and then work at a furious pace until December or January. Then everybody was laid off or fired or let go or something. And then there were like around between January and April were like the lean times in animation, depending on what area of animation you worked in, because they would usually sell the shows for the upcoming season between February and April. And most of the work was done by the staff writers on the developments. And then once they knew what shows they were getting on the air, there would be this flurry of activity as they wrote frantically, and that's when you needed writers to come in and usually work over the summer, which is like in prime time when everybody else is taking hiatus. And so Earl, I met around that time because he had written a development for a Marx Brothers TV show that Filmation was interested in doing.
Nice.
Yeah, and for whatever reason, they couldn't get it sold, you know. There might have been trouble with the Marx's estates, I think.
And also Harpo's voice.
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
That would have been my part. I've been excellent at doing it.
You've just been squeezing the horn, yeah.
Yeah, well, no. I just do the part where Harpo goes.
He's making a face.
Yeah.
He's got his mouth wide open. He's looking around like he's laughing like Harpo does.
But Earl did, you know, really good. He did pretty good Chico and Groucho. So Earl was one of the first guys I met, along with Tom Ruger, because Tom Ruger came in around that time, too. So it was myself, Earl Kress, and Tom Ruger working downstairs in the writer's wing. And upstairs were guys like Tom Minton, and Bruce Tim. Actually, Bruce would be like about 3 years, 2 or 3 years later. But, you know, really interesting folks. Jeff Pigeon, who is over in Pixar now, Filmation was interesting. You were either starting your career or ending it there. There had been a lot of guys who had worked at Warner Brothers or Disney who had either been retired and came out of retirement to pick up a little work, or had just worked all the way through the business and, you know, were still working there. And, you know, it was an interesting place. You could talk to those guys and find out stories about the golden days of animation. And Earl was one of the first guys I met there, and I really kind of was in awe of him because he had worked over at Disney. He had worked on this movie called The Fox and the Hound, which was still, you know, a couple of years away from coming out. And I had heard there had been all this trouble, and there had been a big walkout on the movie. A bunch of the artists had quit on the movie. That didn't really affect Earl, but he had said that he had finished up writing on the movie, and I was interested in getting into more traditional type of writing for Saturday morning cartoons. And Earl and I met throughout the years, and we worked together many, many times here and there. He would come in on shows like Tiny Toons, Animaniacs. He worked...
Mentioned Tom Minton and Tom Ruger, and the three of them worked together on Pinky and the Brain.
Pinky and the Brain. I believe Earl won 2 Emmy Awards for Pinky and the Brain.
Tom had the brain on his tie at the memorial service.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. The brain. It was everywhere.
Yeah.
A little tiny cartoon of him.
Yeah, Earl really shone on Animaniacs and Pinky and the Brain. He did some great work there. I've never known anybody really who had such a passionate love for animation. And this was a guy who worshipped at the temple of Warner Brothers cartoons, Disney, Hanna-Barbera. He was had a flawless knowledge of Hanna-Barbera history and could tell you everything about musical cues, sound effects,
mm-hmm. people who animated which scene,
you know, over at Hanna-Barbera. I know that he worked there off and on writing. I'm not exactly sure if he was on staff there or for how long, but I know that he had sort of became like the honorary records keeper of Hanna-Barbera.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Over years. Well, there are a lot of DVDs where Earl and I appear together and not together, you know, talking back and forth, but we're on commentary for things like, I think we're on Wacky Races, and I know he did Huckleberry Hound. He's all over that, and Yogi Bear, and I think we're both on the Quick Draw one, the one they did that used Quick Draw McGraw. I don't think they've done a special Quick Draw one though. But you know, if you needed to know anything about animation, Earl was the go-to guy, and just, you know, a very warm, brilliant, funny guy. You know, kind of quiet, kind of shy. We had him over to the house a few times.
Oh, he's delightful. Yeah, of course.
Really, really liked him a lot. And everybody had nice things to say about him. And, you know, he's one of those guys who, you know, a little bit of light's gone out of the world now, you know, because of his passing.
And yet there's so much more light in it because he was here.
Yes, that's very true. And as we were driving away from the service, I said, it's really interesting because I guess every generation has this to some degree, but I'm seeing more like in my generation, kids who grew up being entranced by cartoons,
mm-hmm.
and comedians and, mm-hmm. and over-the-top actor personalities. And to us, they are just, you know, people who live in the TV box or we see on screen or, you know, representations of dolls we collect. And we don't really know that much about them when we're kids. And then you get a little older and you realize there's a person behind that. There's, you realize Laurel and Hardy are not just funny guys. They were actually, you know, actors, and this was their history. You realize Yogi Bear was actually voiced by guys named Dawes Butler. Bugs Bunny was voiced by Mel Blanc, and, you know, and this guy, and, you know, when you're our age, you realize at that time, these guys are still around, and they're still making that stuff. And then you grow up being passionate about it and wanting to get involved in it in some way, and then you're lucky enough to come here to Los Angeles and start a career doing that, and then you meet some of these people, you work with them, and then there's a sort of wonderful golden time, which can be short or long, where you know the guy or the girl, the person whose work you enjoy, mm-hmm. you get to work with them a bit, get to know them a bit personally or socially, and then, you know, people go on, they age, and then some cases people find themselves the caretaker of that person when they get a little older, and then it ultimately ends with you, you know, saying something at their memorial. And I guess what sort of struck me was Earl was all those things, and, you know, he's really the first one to pass who had that role of my generation, I guess.
Yeah.
So, but you're right. You know, definitely there's a loss, but, you know, we remember and remember the good things.
And we are lucky to have loved him.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
to continue to do so.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a real sweet guy. And it was really fascinating being at his service today, because there were so many people there who loved him deeply and had relationships with him I didn't know existed, like his stepdaughters.
Yes.
No idea he had stepdaughters. I had no idea he had grandkids. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. And I knew he had a wife, but I didn't know how many. It's like he had been divorced once, and his first mm-hmm. wife was there. And it was really fascinating peeling back layers, as Shrek would say, like an onion.
Yeah.
Although Earl was certainly the farthest thing from an ogre, he was so delightful all the time.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like...
But just going, I had no idea. Wow, I had no idea he did that kind thing for this person.
Yeah.
And loving someone even more as a result of those who loved them and whose lives they touched.
Well, it was the same with Dwayne McDuffie earlier this year.
Well, yeah.
Because I actually got mad. I couldn't really get mad at Dwayne, but I got a little bit mad after leaving one of the memorials for him that it was one of those things where I didn't know you were a physicist. I didn't know your interests were in this way or that way. I would have liked to have talked with you a little bit more about something other than, Wonder Woman or.
Yeah,
can the Flash outrun his Superman?
Degree, Dwayne McDuffie's degree from University of Michigan was in like astrophysics.
Yeah,
and I think he went up through. He didn't get his PhD, did he?
I'm not sure.
He may have.
I heard he had a couple different degrees, right?
He had a ton of degrees. Yeah.
He was a genius.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A genius who just devoted his life to, fun things and giving other people opportunities and doing the best job he can.
And in addition all of that, and creating Static Shock, which was iconic and mm-hmm. rule-breaking and groundbreaking
line,
and
really.
Also excellent. What?
The whole Milestone line, really.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the whole Milestone Comics line. That was just, it was remarkable what those guys accomplished in such a, really a relatively mm-hmm. short period of time and the high-quality work and the quantity
yeah.
of high-quality work they were able to put out. But in addition to that, he was also super warm.
Yeah.
And he was very present. And he was very engaging and mm-hmm. and engaged all the time to every single person that he spoke with and connected. And this is both true for Earl and Wayne.
Sure.
It's amazing when you meet somebody that balanced
mm-hmm.
and how much he has to offer.
Right.
And again, it's one of those things where it's like how lucky we are to have loved him.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, you can say that whenever anybody passes.
It's not really always. True. Sometimes it's like, well, good.
We don't really know anybody like that.
No, I don't. I never.
And you don't
have.
Say it out loud.
No, you might as well. But I've never had a loss in my life that I haven't mourned.
Yeah.
Because I have never had somebody come into my life that, at the very least, even if we can't get along, hasn't taught me something.
Right.
From every single relationship I've learned. Right. There's something to take away and be grateful for.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. So, well, that was today. And busy
part
day.
Of today.
Part
busy
of today.
Day.
Well.
Yeah, we got up and did doggy boot camp, as you know, that went awry.
Yes.
And then came back, quickly showered, let everybody in. The exterminator was here because Paul's been out killing rats.
Yep.
You want to give us a little highlight on the doggy goings-ons?
We can't really say anything about the doggy goings-ons other than Muggsy is doing a great job at doggy boot camp.
And Deuce apparently is doing a great job somewhere else.
Deuce
in
is doing what
dog
Deuce...
juvie, as we call it.
We'll have an update on that later.
Yeah, we can't because it's the episode will air.
Yeah, we can't talk at all about that.
Yeah, the episode will air next year. So that's, we're not allowed to say anything.
I just saw a nice preview for Arkham City.
Oh, yeah?
It was a very Joker-centric preview for Arkham City that had some nice shots of him inside his...
His
lair.
I didn't hear what you said.
Oh, yeah. The Joker inside his lair preparing for one of his
what does a Joker's lair look like?
In this version, it changes a lot in the
does
comics.
Does he have a giant penny and a dinosaur, too?
No.
Oh.
I mean, it changes. I mean, he's not as mobile as...
Ezra just gave me a look.
I mean, he's much more mobile than Batman because he's always getting arrested or...
So does he live in a trashy RV?
No.
That would be awesome.
Well, he changes from time to time.
Yeah,
he finds
things appropriate to him.
Yeah. I mean, in the classic comics, there was the Joker's hideout, and it was pretty well appointed. There were giant cards on the wall, and a big desk, and a big fancy chair. And I guess whenever he got out of jail, either he was released or he escaped. He went back to wherever his hidden lair was. But then again, when you're a career criminal, you can't really have. I actually dealt with this in an issue of I think it was Detective, where the Riddler, who's cleaned up his act and is now operating as a detective, tried to buy a house. I'm making money, people are hiring me, I've licensed my name, I'm making money, I want to buy a house.
and he couldn't get one because his credit rating was so lousy. And,
oh.
And, you know, ultimately he had the cash to get it, I think, or was getting the cash together.
Yeah, but who would want him in the neighborhood?
Well, you know, ultimately what happened was Bruce Wayne took a, in this story, took a chance on him and actually gave him a task to do and said, if you do this job for Wayne Industries, an employee of mine stole some stuff. If you get it back, I'll, you know, put my name on the house application.
Co-sign your loan.
Co-sign the loan or give him the money or something. So actually,
if
I don't think...
If only the Riddler knew, right?
Well,
yeah. Some detective, he is not figuring it out.
Well, actually, you know, what happened was he got the stuff, gave it, actually fulfilled his duty, gave the stuff back to Bruce Wayne when he should have stole it, but I think he wanted the house more than anything. He was actually trying in this case. And Wayne just wrote him a check. He cashed the check and went, and I guess he paid cash for his house, for his townhouse, which apparently you can do. I understand that wealthy people can do that. They can actually write a check and buy a house.
But Joker, yeah, Joker usually leans to, since he can't have a stable hideout, he like goes for toy shop, old toy factories.
He goes for something kind of, you know.
Something that whatever the realtor finds for him.
Right? Yeah. Oh, the broker.
The broker.
Yeah. The broker. And then he hires the carpenter to fix it up.
Yeah. As everybody else
and
does.
And then tries to kill her.
As everybody else does. Yes.
You know, you figure guys would change their MOs, you know, like the Joker would think, for instance, maybe a furniture store this time. It could be a wacky furniture store, but maybe he won't
inflatable chairs.
Well, he won't catch me if I keep, you know, how many five and dime and trick stores and magic stores and costume stores and prank stores are in Gotham City? They must have made, again, in one of my stories, I said that at one point they made a lot of stores and amusement parks. And
I wonder if there's ever a time where a bad guy's holed up in an old abandoned amusement park or something, and another bad guy comes going, perfect place for my hide. Oh, you're already here.
Well, they would have to take it up with the broker, because the broker, you know, sold
him
the same place.
He sells all those properties,
yeah.
You know, I'll tell you where my secret hideout would be, is Sealy Furniture.
Sealy Furniture.
You know that giant Sealy Furniture warehouse in Glendale that's all gutted out, and they're using it for studio space right now with the big giant letters that across the street from Checkers.
Yeah, is that Sealy?
It's Sealy Furniture.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, S-E-E-L-E-Y.
Yeah, that's right. Across the street from Checkers. Yeah. So
yeah,
Mushroom Swiss Burger.
Stop it with that. I want one so bad.
I haven't had
a Mushroom Swiss Burger in months.
I know. It's like
it's like my going back to Michigan burger, kind of. And when I found out that they had it here, I have to confess, I was a little disappointed, and I was like, well, it doesn't taste the same in California, because there's something about being home.
Yeah.
And you pull into, it's like when you come to California and you go to In-N-Out.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, In-N-Out, which is a huge burger chain here.
But Batman must have it, you know.
Oh, Batman, yeah.
Well, you know.
We're talking about that.
It's like, he doesn't need a computer, he just needs like a phone book, you know. Poison Ivy broke out again, okay, give me a list of greenhouses, plant supply stores.
Parks.
You know, farm supply places, and it's like, you know, laziest thing in the world.
Hydroponic biology area.
Yeah, you know, vegan restaurants. Oh, here's one called the Lusty Fern. I bet she's holed up there. Okay, let's
I think it's interesting that she would only eat vegan. Why wouldn't she eat only meat?
Yeah,
I guess
because
plants nourish her.
Okay.
I don't know.
She should just eat fertilizer and sunlight.
Yeah. Cow shit.
All right.
That was crass.
I don't know. It's,
I seriously, that doesn't make sense. Why she would eat only, I mean, that would be like us only eating humans, right?
Well, she's nutty. Maybe she's nuts. So,
okay.
No, I think she's, well, I don't know. It just seemed one of those things that sort of made sense that she was if she was a vegan, because she could think that plants nourish her and they keep her alive to keep the plants alive. Same reason. Why, you know. But But don't we eat the antelopes and the Lion King that we saw this week? Yes, but then the antelopes die and they become the grass. The antelope eat the grass.
Oh,
so it's a circle of life.
All right, it's a circle of life.
Okay.
That's fine. So I'm thinking about that electrical guy on Scooby-Doo. Who was like, you know, the electrical villain that they had?
Yeah.
That kind of looked like the Michelin Man, but he was red and yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And he would feed off of live wires and things. Like, he'd put his hand, if I'm remembering correctly. Granted, I was three when I saw it, so I don't know. But he would, like, put his hand on electricity and get stronger. So maybe that's what's going on.
Well, he was a guy in a suit.
But electricity isn't a living thing.
He fed
thing.
Off I mean, nothing. So he was probably, you know, old Mr. Jenkins.
We're bringing
in the
too much logic into this.
Well, there are villains. Like, there's a Hulk villain called Zax, who's the same thing.
Zax, like Zaxxon. Remember Coleco?
Yeah.
You don't even know what Coleco is.
Of course I had Coleco.
Like, it was my first cousin.
Coleco. I had
Did you ever play Smurf on it? Was Cubert on Coleco?
I think everything was on
Coleco. Yeah, Cubert was on Coleco. Yeah.
I remember Zaxxon. Did you play Zaxxon?
Yeah.
I've never played Zaxxon, but I played Smurfs.
Yeah. Dun, 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 dun. Or is that Frogger?
I think it was Burger Time.
Yeah, that was Burger Time.
No, I never played Burger Time. How would I know that theme song?
I don't know. That sounds like a burger.
It sounds like Burger Time. It was just like
Guy. You know what I loved about it was that it would play that song, and then if you killed the Smurf at the very end, it would go dun 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 dun. Pew.
And was that,
like, that was the noise they made when they died?
Would you like spin in a circle and
no, it just fell on its back and thunk.
Yeah.
Peril.
And so should they all.
No. Wow. Somebody was telling me that they saw the very first Smurfettes. It was Sam Tweedle called the other day.
Yeah.
And was saying that he read the very first Smurfette story, and it is pretty misogynistic.
It's what happens is Gargamel decides to create discord among the Smurfs. So he creates a female Smurf.
Now, wait a minute. If Gargamel can create Smurfs, but he wants to eat Smurfs, why doesn't he just cook his own dinner?
He needs real Smurfs to turn into gold, I thought.
What?
No. I mean, as we all found out from Robot Chicken, when they did the Smurf episode of Robot Chicken, Brainy Smurf goes over and asks him a couple of questions, and one of them is, wait, do you want to eat us or do you want to turn us to gold? And Gargamel says, oh, I don't know. My motivation was never very clear in that regard.
Okay,
so even the guys at Hanna-Barbera didn't know when they did the cartoon. Peyo, I don't even remember what he had to say about it. I mean, I remember meeting Peyo and talking to him about
it. Is he still around?
No, he passed away in the 80s.
I'm sorry to hear that. Was he nice?
He's a nice fellow. He thought of Gargamel as basically this old faker hermit who lived out in the woods. And I think he recognized his value as a villain, and he showed up enough in the original comic books, but I know he was kind of talking about getting away from Gargamel because it was really easy in Saturday morning milieu to always use Gargamel with another plot against the Smurfs. He becomes Wile E. Coyote very easily.
Yeah, yeah.
Were characters like Pee-wee from the Magic Flute more common characters in the Peyo series, or are those additional?
No, usually this is interesting. Usually the strife was generated among the Smurfs themselves, which is when I started reading the Smurfs or Schtroumpfs or whatever they were called in French class. We would get comic books. Our French teacher gave us comic books.
That's a cool teacher.
Yeah, and so we would read Asterix and Smurfs and Tintin and things like that.
It's a good way to learn a language.
I mean, he brought them as a supplement, you know, so it's like, okay, read this. And the Smurfs, I always thought, were really funny in kind of a Pogo-esque type of way because, like, with the characters in Pogo, like the turtle, the owl, Albert Alligator, they're all kind of each other's own worst enemy, and you don't need Wile E. Cat or the Deacon or Sarcophagus Macabre showing up to be
an what a great name.
I know that was my favorite Pogo name, which was this buzzard named Sarcophagus Macabre.
Oh, that makes more sense.
He was a very erudite
mummy.
He was a very erudite vulture who ran the undertaking service in the swamp. And in some strips, he is an out and out villain. But in later years, Kelly used him more, and he became kind of this sort of snobbish sophisticate, you know, who would. And every time he rendered his word balloon, it was in like black lined box. It looked like a funeral announcement.
Nice.
Whereas the Deacon had old Gothic, and which made him sound like an old professorial type. And but every time I read Sarcophagus's dialogue, I would hear like Vincent Price in my head, which is ironic because Vincent Price did the voice of the Deacon in a Pogo animated movie. I'll leave all that aside. Anyway. The original stories were funny because they were sort of their own worst enemies, and they didn't really need Gargamel as a threat because quite often it involved rivalries and bitterness and hatreds such as they were among the Smurfs themselves. But you know, it was always patched up by the end of the story. It's like Asterix. The Gauls in the little village always fight among themselves. You don't need the Romans all the time.
Right.
When it became Saturday morning, they really took what little edge was on the Smurfs from the comics. And that's when I said, oh, Smurfs are on. Oh, I got to watch that. That'll be really funny. And then when I watched it, it became kind of dumbed down and very sweet. It became what it really wasn't in the comics. And that is very sticky and very sweet and not as funny as it was in the comics, where the drawing was real crisp and the translations were really on the nose. And it was great. Even in the original French, when I could read it and I understood it more or less, I thought, this is really very funny. It's on a par with the best U.S. stuff I was reading at the time. Hmm. And then it just kind of got watered down. It would have been like if they had made Pogo into a group of very Disney-esque funny animals and took away all the political stuff and the nonsense and the kind of weird, you know, whimsical touch and just made it all cute. We got the phone ringing in the background, so
we'll go to that. Yeah, busy day. It's like a grand festival here.
It's just nonstop. So that was my French class in high school. Oh, I'm actually going back to my high school next week. It's homecoming.
Yeah, you are. Your brother is now coaching the football team. How weird.
And wow. Teaching history.
How things come around. Yeah. And teaching history, and how apropos.
Yep. So were we going to talk any more about cartoons or comics or anything like that? Let's see, what
any
else?
Comments on the Batman Catwoman?
Oh, well, that's what we were talking about. Wow. Wait a minute, we were talking about the. We were talking about the. We were talking about characters' hideouts. That was that was one thing. It was. I don't know why Poison Ivy's a vegan. It just worked.
Oh, we're
out
back
that
on
way.
This soon.
I don't know.
You know, I want answers though. I want someone to answer.
All right, she eats corn dogs. She eats nothing but corn dogs and Chinese. How about that?
Corn dogs are meat, kind of.
Yeah,
and they're all corn. You got both.
But they're also poison, so she's immune to that, so she can eat whatever she wants.
Okay, so she could eat things like foxglove and plants, like nightshade plants, that things that we can't have.
She just walks around with a pet platypus and sucks off its spur.
Okay.
That is wrong.
You know what? I'm just sitting back, and I'm going to let you talk about Catwoman and Batman getting it on.
Okay. Oh, no. The way back to what we were originally talking with is the Joker in this one is hiding out in the old metalworks, which he has sort of reconverted into his hideout. So it has a really cool, almost sort of like hellish look to it, where the old metalworks are still up and working, and there's furnaces going and everything like that. It's a pretty cool location for him.
Very.
He's got these little trains that go around through the old Psionis metalworks plant that look like little Joker head cars. You get in there, it's like fun house attractions, and some of them take you through the place, some of them take you directly to the Joker, and some of them just drop you off in the furnace. Or at least that's what I put in the comic book. And,
okay.
And the comic book, the graphic novel's coming out too. Everything's coming out October 18th.
Yeah.
October 18th is a big day for me. It's like Arkham City, the game, Arkham City, the hardcover graphic novel, I'm collecting all the elements of the comic book story prequel, and the Batman Year One direct-to-video, or DVD, which also has the Catwoman short, the 15-minute Catwoman short that I wrote in there.
Oh, nice, yeah.
Yes, and speaking of Catwoman, I guess there's been some heat on her this week because of the latest.
If you will.
I mean,
yeah, there's been a lot of things on Catwoman this week, including Batman, apparently. Yes.
Didn't seem too horrible as far as the pictures I saw, but they're definitely.
Well, Guillaume Marsh is really good. He's a terrific artist. He drew it.
Mm-hmm. Who wrote the book, Grant?
I don't know who wrote the book. I think it might be Judd Winnick. No, you know what? I haven't been to the comic book store in like 2 weeks, so I've missed out on a bunch of the titles. Last time I was in a comic book store was in London, and I got the first release of the new DC books. So I haven't been up on what's happening. I guess I should go down there. I heard the new Batman book was pretty good, and I have to pick up that first issue. Catwoman I haven't seen yet. I think it's very interesting, though, that, man, every time I was writing Streets of Gotham, Sirens, mm-hmm. I could never have them do anything more than just like hug or, you know, a very chaste kiss to the forehead.
Yeah, that being said, the whole DC line seems to blurred those horror and sex genres a little bit more. Like all the Vertigo stuff seems to be more incorporated into their universe.
Well, you know, I got a very weird comment from DC once where I wanted to do something very adult in one of the books. Although not by comparison to what's happening in the books this week, apparently. And the editorial reply came back, we're going to have to change this because we don't want, you know, this is a good story and we like it and everything. We like the character's interaction in theory. However, for us to really do this, this has to be a much bigger event than just in a regular issue of the book. Yeah. And I was like, okay, well, all right. So I guess, you know, they want to save their big moments for the highly promotable events and everything. So, I heard about it and I saw that image online. So I'm going like, well, good for Batman. He needs to loosen up.
Yeah.
I was actually listening to Kevin and Jennifer Smith's podcast a few days ago, and they were talking about some Batman stuff, and because I had missed a lot of their podcasts, and I sort of wanted to hear it to see, like, oh, well, here's another husband and wife team that does a podcast. And they were actually talking a lot about Batman. They were talking about some episodes that I had done for the animated series, and I think Kevin wants to do, like, a Batman-centric podcast at some point.
That'd be cool.
So that would be cool to go on there and discuss some Batman stuff with him.
We could tag team up and do a Clerks-centric animated podcast with him.
Well, yeah, could, I guess, and talk about Clerks, the animated series.
Yeah.
Let's see, what else is going on? Tower prep news? I don't have any tower prep news, and part of me thinks there's not really going to be any tower prep news, because just every time I've asked about it in the last few weeks, there's been nothing but silence, and that to me says things are probably not looking up for a second season or a revival anytime soon. I hate to say it, but yeah, I don't have the final word on it. Things could change.
Of course not, but unfortunately it is, you know, starting to get to that point where most networks don't really reinvest in shows too long after they've been off the air.
Right, right. And they're not even reshowing it anymore, mm-hmm. which was kind of unbelievable to me. But, you know, for people who have asked, all I can say is that, you know, going back a year to when they started airing, when they premiered Unnatural History, I don't exactly know what the deal was. I think they had so much invested and their hopes were so high for their live action launch, maybe unrealistically so, that when the numbers came in on Unnatural History, and they weren't bad, they were, you know, like any new show starting off, you know, you need to build an audience. But I think there were a couple of weeks of numbers and that just made the folks, especially the folks in Atlanta, say, oh, we give up. We're out. We shouldn't be here. And I just think at that point, even though Tower Prep was still halfway through production and we were finishing the scripts and we were 5 months from our premiere, I think they just sort of, I think at that point they just sort of made a decision to, like, okay, well, we're in the wrong place. We shouldn't be here. Which is ironic because Unnatural History got a nice big following. And Tower Prep, you know, the numbers were kind of the same. I think our numbers were a little bit higher at first and they may have tapered off. But then again, it's the end of the year. It's getting close to the holidays, and that's to be expected. And I think the really ironic thing is that looking back over their history, yeah, there have been a few shows like Adventure Time that start off with spectacular ratings. There are also shows like Samurai Jack that start off really big and then bottom out or level out after a while.
Still a great show, but yeah.
And then there are shows, I think Looney Tunes started off with decent ratings. Now it's getting spectacular ratings. And I think that, you know, any show that I've seen become a long-term hit on Cartoon Network did so because of repetition. Mm-hmm. They would show the initial run of episodes. In some cases, they would show, like, 6 episodes of a new series, then pull it for 2 months, then reshow those 6 episodes, put in 1 new episode, you know, redo it, and then reshow the whole thing. I don't even know what their scheduling is. I guess I should be grateful that we had 11 weeks straight through where they did nothing but run the show. They didn't, you know, pull us off for a week.
But they gave it no chance for anybody who missed an episode to catch up. And
yeah,
I mean, me and a couple other friends have commented during the airings that, like, oh, I missed that last episode. How are we going to watch it? You know, did you PVR it? Did you know? Because they aren't re-airing them. They don't even replay them right before they air the new one.
Yeah, and then they would switch the times around, you know? It's like, we were on at 8, and no, suddenly we're on at 9, and suddenly, well, we're not even sure where we're going to run it. And I would yell at them, and I go, why, you know, nobody can find the show. And they say, well, Paul, you have to understand that, you know, TV Guide requires a minimum of 4 weeks before you change the schedule. And I said, no, that's not right. They run things, you know, they're...
That the TV Guide hasn't been right in ages, and nobody uses TV Guide anymore. They use any form of digital or online look resource, and those get updated constantly.
Yeah, well, it's like, okay, well, TV Guide is one thing, but how come it's not on the programming crawl on my cable box? Mm-hmm. How come it's not on your website? How come, you know, people see it at one point, you know, here and another time here? You know, it's really, guys, you got to step up if you want to be a professional big-time TV network. And I think the answer came back is, we're not a professional big-time TV network. We're Cartoon Network, and we run our shows and our import shows and our Adult Swim, and that's the way it is. And, you know, the subsequent, you know, conversations I had with them where I point out inconsistencies in programming time and, you know, switching air dates and things like that, it would, and about how those were leading to, you know, look, the show's falling off, they'd say, yeah, well, the ratings aren't there. And then trying to get the show restarted again, they just kept saying, the ratings weren't there. Paul, look at the numbers. The ratings were not there. And I said, the ratings wasn't there. Neither was the consistency of the programming. Neither was anything. Neither was the publicity. Yeah. You know, where's the follow-up publicity to the thing, you know? You do a show with four very charismatic stars, and you're not looking at any way to get them out on talk shows or in some sort of venue. Disney does all these promotional things where
they'll have their stars on the network all day long talking about the other cartoons and doing intros about them just to get their faces up.
Well, yes, that's right. And I think that Cartoon Network publicity knew these things, which is precisely why they didn't do them. Because by the time Comic-Con rolled around, I think we were a dead show walking. You know, just sort of like,
that's unfortunate.
We just, you know, we shouldn't even be here. And then the fact that, you know, and I would point out to them later, hey, you know, I've got all these letters from parents, and there's this letter writing campaign, and, you know it's not going to happen, but kids are talking boycott and everything, and now there's all this big buzz about it. And they're just saying, like, leave us alone. You know, come on. We don't want to talk about that anymore. So that's where things lie now. I'm sorry, but it's possible that, you know, a few years down the road, or maybe even as soon as tomorrow, it could have a phoenix-like resurrection. Yeah. But I'm kind of thinking, like, that the bell is rung and Cartoon Network's live action, at least as far as Tower Prep goes. So and that's about as much as you can do.
Not for want of trying.
It was not for want of trying, and even though I'm not one of those guys who gets online and tries to rally people to a cause, and because I knew fans were already doing that. Yeah, it wasn't for lack of trying to get Cartoon Network back on the air. It's just, and I know, and I'm aware that there were letter writing campaigns and boycotts and emails, and everybody was asking Cartoon Network about it and everything, and for which I am grateful. But you know, being on the inside, I know what the mindset is, and I know how intractable sometimes certain networks can be, and that's why I didn't take a bigger hand in whipping up the fans. I just thought, you know, fans were doing it, they might as well, you know, let them continue.
You're pursuing your own ways of trying to get it going again and trying to take another direction with it.
Right. So, you know, and ultimately it has to be, well, I just gotta learn from the experience and go on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. And that's it, you know. I mean, there was a very, very clear harbinger of this, in that right around the premiere, I was talking to one of the Cartoon Network execs, and he says, well, you know, we don't really know what we have. It could be something that could run five seasons, or maybe it's something that's off in a few weeks and people just have as a fond memory. And I think that was his way of tipping me off, like, it's going to be off in a few weeks and a fond memory. Although, seriously, you have it, even if you're not going to renew the show. You don't want to reshow it at some point?
Yeah.
It's like free programming.
It. Yeah.
I think what happened was, and this is really ironic, early on, there were a few very vocal kids who were very passionate about cartoons, and I think that's fine, who got online once they announced this, and they did video clips where they said, I don't think Cartoon Network should be doing live action. I like cartoons, this, that, and everything else. And some of them were, you know, very demonstrative about it. Some of them were more open-minded about it. And I don't know how many were out there, but I think people at Cartoon Network saw those and that just went, oh my God, what have we done?
Yeah, unfortunately, the people who are always against something are the loudest.
Yes.
And
Cartoon who hadn't seen anything.
Networks are very likely to react to fan reaction.
Yeah, but they hadn't seen anything yet. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, oh my God, it's little kids. It's not fanboys who are like in their 20s. It's our core audience. It's kids who are saying, I don't want live action on Cartoon Network, which is ironic because I've seen much more online recently fans saying, what's going to happen to the Tower Prep kids? We really want to see it.
Yeah.
Here's I've made my own fan Tower Prep film.
Nice.
I've made my answers to all the questions. Yeah. I've made, you know, here's what we know about Suki. Here's what we know about Ian, you know, and it's just as much, if not more. Their kids who are now coming out and saying, oh, hey, you know, I want this back. But by now the die is pretty much cast. So I think it's like, you know, eh. So I think, you know, maybe 20 years from now, if there's some kid who liked the show out there who grows up to be a director or something, you could go to whatever's left of Cartoon Network at that time and buy the rights from them and make Tower Prep the movie or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the most heartbreaking thing is that kids have, or fans have been saying to me, why doesn't another network buy it? Why don't, Paul, why don't you take it to another network? One.
Why don't you make comics, why don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Here's why. I didn't. I created the show, but I sold it to them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was the condition of the deal. You want a show, you sell it to Cartoon Network, like the same with any other creator. So they own the show. The other thing was, so they can either air the show or lock it in a vault or just, you know, commission new episode. It's their, it's whatever they want to do. They have the option of doing with it. So I don't have any control over what happens with the show. I have a say if it comes back, you know, then I'm still attached to the show as the creator, and that's its own thing. But the rights are with them as far as they want to show the show or not.
Mm-hmm.
And kids have said, why don't they sell it to another network, or why don't you take it to Sci-Fi, or take it, you know, to ABC Family? And, you know, again, this comes from being inside the business. ABC Family is Disney. They're not going to bargain for a Warner Brothers show. Sci-fi, it's not really sci-fi, you know, material, although there might be, you know, potentially some interest. The thing that they keep it from going on to another show, another network is, one, Cartoon Network won't release it. They've said as much. They're just tabling it and locking it away, as is their prerogative. And two, which is even a bit more heartbreaking, I've talked to people at other networks and none of them have seen it. Or none of them know about it.
Yeah. You actually walked into a writer's room a couple months ago.
Yes.
And somebody congratulated you on the show and asked when it would air.
Yes.
Oh, my.
And they know me.
That's how much attention it got.
They know me from writing Batman. They know me from writing Arkham City. They know me from writing, you know, animated stuff. They know me from upcoming Spider-Man and Hulk series. And when I mentioned Tower Prep, they said, when is that coming out?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, last year, there was a flyer distributed from Warner Brothers to all the people here in the Rancho, which was sort of a PR flyer of everything happening at Warner Brothers, and it listed movies that won't be coming out until 2013. It listed every show on their roster for every talk show, entertainment show on their TV roster, things like Ellen, Two and a Half Men, all that stuff. It listed shows in development. It listed Cartoon Network shows like Looney Tunes and Ben 10 and everything, and some shows that haven't even been, you know, haven't premiered yet. And it mentioned a Natural History, and it did not mention Tower Prep.
Uh-huh.
And at that point, I kind of got this sick feeling in the pit of my stomach, like they've already decided to kind of, you know, nobody's going to talk about the show. And we went there. We had a minimal presence at Comic-Con. In 2010. We went to Atlanta, where we had to drum up our own publicity, you know, to do the show right mm-hmm. there in Atlanta, where Cartoon Network is. And the week of the show's premiere, 2 weeks before the show's premiere, at the New York Comic Con, there were spotlight panels on Adult Swim,
Gumball,
and I think Mad, and everything, and mm-hmm. nothing about Tower Prep. Mm-hmm. So we were already on the block then. I mean, even if we had gotten a 3.0 rating, which was about what Adventure Time got. Probably a little less, but Adventure Time got spectacular ratings. But even if it had, I think that we would have, they might have gone as far as selling the show or something. What happened was they never followed up with publicity in any other venue. And then that's the thing is, like, Disney decides, okay, we're not only going to do this show, but it's going to be a hit, and this is how we're promoting it.
Mm-hmm.
When they put out a Natural History.
Look at Real Steel, for example. Everybody who is driving around Los Angeles, I don't know how it is in other cities, but you can't drive by a bus stop
mm-hmm.
without seeing the Real Steel Noisy Boy. I know that the villain in that movie is Noisy Boy. I know that he's purple and yellow because I have seen him a million times.
Yeah.
And I know Hugh Jackman's in it. I know Evangeline Lilly's in it because there was spot after spot after spot on every channel.
Well, that's Disney promotion. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. I'm supporting you in what you're saying is when Disney decides you're going to watch something, you're at least going to know about it.
Well, you know, years ago when they first started promoting Hannah Montana, I remember you and I were driving by and we saw the first image of Miley Cyrus
with
the little blonde hair and the fringy jacket.
And I said, Hillary Duff has been replaced.
Yes.
Remember that?
Here's the new Hillary Duff, you know, mm-hmm. to be replaced by the Miley Cyrus, Demi Lovato, and, you know, mm-hmm. all the others. Mm-hmm. And with Tower Prep, they had it in their hand, you know, and they didn't know what to do with it or else they'd bitten off more than they could chew, because what I heard was from Atlanta, is like, we don't know how to promote these shows. We don't know how to sell this. We only have X amount of money for our promotion budget. We can't do more than that. If the show is a hit, it's a hit.
We can't think of a new angle. We're using all the 50 that we use already.
Anyway.
Well, and the lousy thing is right before it came on, Paul and I sat and we drafted two things. We drafted a press release and we drafted 14 different viral campaign ideas for them.
Mm-hmm.
We did marketing's job.
Yeah.
Not that it's, you know, you can just hand someone a list and it executes itself.
No, but...
But if they could have picked two, and they were pretty good, you know, and it, if I do say so myself, I worked my ass off on
that. Yeah, I know you did.
And they complimented Paul on it, said, these are really clever. Thank you for this. We'll turn it over. Nothing.
Mm-hmm. It's like they stuck in a drawer.
Yeah, not that there's much solace in this, but... Most of the marketing department, from what I understand, so again, I could be wrong, has been let go
since then. Well, some of them got promoted. Some of them got big promotions.
Who?
Well, I don't know any names, but I did hear so-and-so who worked in promotions got a nice promotion because of this. And it's like, you know, and maybe that was, you know, for bringing the axe to the live-action stuff. Mm-hmm. Because they never re-showed that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They're not putting it on DVD.
Mm-hmm.
That's
what seems a shame to me, because I believe... Wholeheartedly, like a lot of other TV shows and such, it would have a strength in life in DVD, and all these people that talk about it would be able to share it with their friends, mm-hmm. and it would grow.
Well, that's why it's not going to be on. That is exactly why it's not going to be on DVD. They do not want it back. They do not. You know, the way I heard it, and here I am blowing some confidences, and I'm probably going to get smashed by this, but I don't care anymore. The way I heard it spoken to me by. A source I won't divulge was in Atlanta that people were kind of saying this is too big of a game changer for us. We would rather have it be perceived as a failure of creative, not a failure of us. So if we put it out there, we can show that we promoted it. You can't deny that we didn't put out a press release. We put out an ad in the People's Special magazine spotlighting Glee right there. That your show was on the air. Unfortunately, we're going to run it opposite Glee, so the Glee audience is never going to see your show. But, you know, I just think it was quietly swept under the rug and forgotten. So if it is not to be forgotten... And the other thing was, it happened right before we could get some breakthrough attention from the mainstream media. We did not get any... We got a very dismissive write-up in EW, Entertainment Weekly, which is a Warner Brothers magazine, but, you know.
You got a really nice write-up in Variety.
We got a nice write-up in Variety. A lot of places, we got really nice write-ups. And I think that we were just before, when a show starts getting interesting to a mainstream audience, they start catching on, and then a few fringe kind of writers write about, this is going beyond the initial reviews, some writers pick up some ideas, and then they write about it for their TV week, or it starts to become a cult hit. We were... chopped in the neck right before it got to that point.
Yeah.
I would say to some of the publicity people, you know, you have a young energetic cast, you know, you're connected with AOL. Why not have like AOL spotlights on them? The Ellen Show, it tapes right here in Burbank. It's a Warner Brothers show, daytime talk show.
Yeah.
We have a very handsome, pretty, charismatic cast. Put on Ryan or Drew or you know, any of the cast members could go on there. You know, it's like, you know, at that point, it's like... Yeah, it's like, sure. Oh, yeah, we'll do that. And I would get notes. Well, you know, we only have X amount of money for a budget. We have a lot of shows to promote. And, you know, I think the big fatal failing was a year before all this, we're doing live action, but they didn't really cleverly rebrand what they were doing. Like, even before that, when they started Adult Swim, I think this is the nature of the shows on Adult Swim, they had to brand it as something different. And I think that because they did separate intros and they did the separate Adult Swim branding, that mom and dads who were worried about kids, you know, who might see inappropriate things, they kind of knew after a period of promotion at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, depending on the night, Cartoon Network ends and Adult Swim begins. And I think if they had been smart and done something like...
Middle ground, like a...
Well,
time for tweens. Or,
yeah.
You know, something
like that. Okay, 8 o'clock, Monday nights, Cartoon Network ends.
It's the rock block.
And then comes, CN Live or something like that. Mm-hmm. And tonight is Unnatural History. And that's going to run for 13 weeks. And then Tower Prep, and that's going to run for some weeks. Yeah. Or else have, you know, the Destroy shows as their intro. I don't know what our intro was. They kept changing the schedule on us. To this day, I don't know when Brave and the Bold is on, and I have at least two episodes on that I've never even seen. Mm-hmm. And I've been told, they've already aired in Britain. I did see one of them, and it was great. So that's pretty much, you know, why things went down and why things are not, you know.
It seems funny to me, just, I mean, I know Adult Swim and Cartoon Network are two practically different companies, but Adult Swim seems to be leaning more and more towards the live action stuff, and
that's kind of they have live action and Venture Brothers and
the Children's Hospital, which I just don't understand, and
live action Venture Brothers, really?
Awesome show.
No, they don't have live action. I said they have live action and
Venture
Brothers and Aqua Teen and Squidbillies. And then they're rerunning Family Guy. And that's kind of like all they're doing.
Well,
now
it seems to become more and more of a venue for comedians who may have who do double
that's
duty
true.
In comics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
cartoons
and then do a live action show as well or something like
those
that.
Those are all big time comedians, Rob Corddry and all of them doing those.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, the cast on Children's Hospital is pretty impressive. So, I mean, but then again, I just think they did this sort of halfway, you know, and you know, one of the real heartbreaking things was about the show was about 6 weeks into its run, I was having a meeting with a Disney exec who, you know, we were talking about the show and he hadn't seen it because he couldn't find it. And he said, you know, I had actually seen the Tower Prep pilot. And for a minute there, we were really scared. We really thought you guys were serious because he had seen the pilot. He'd seen that it was a good show. And then once Cartoon Network started shifting the time, and, you know, dicking around with the schedule, once he saw there was nothing else coming, there was no follow-up to support the show, it was like, whew, oh, wow, we dodged a bullet. Yeah, we got live action all to ourselves. And he was right.
Mm-hmm.
He was right. And, you know, it was kind of a crummy meeting from that point on, but it was sort of like, you know, for 1 minute, they were a little bit scared, you know. Nick wasn't scared. They went on about 41 episodes of House of Anubis because it was
knew it was going to work.
They knew it was going to work. So.
And House of Anubis is very similar.
Well,
it's not litigiously similar.
No,
but it's close enough.
But it showed there was a market for that
kind
of thing.
Exactly. That's a better way of putting
it. And now Cartoon Network executives are saying, "I wish we had a House of Anubis."
You did, ass.
Speaking about similarities and parallels, a lot of people have asked in blogs and such if you were familiar with Morning Glories, the new comic book series.
No. Oh, no, here's what happened. Not when I created the show. What happened was I became aware of the show once we it was like, I guess, of March of...
Well, Morning Glories is the comic book.
Yeah, I know. It came out, it debuted in like... I saw the first ad for Morning Glories in like March or April of last year.
It was well
year.
After you were already
established.
Yeah.
We were filming.
So I don't know.
I just wondered if you had, you know, because some people were wondering if you had read it, if you'd appreciate it, if there was, you know, anything that you liked about it, things like that.
I didn't read it. I mean, I think I looked through the first issue just to see how close it was.
Yeah.
And I just thought,
do go on their own tangents.
This is amazing coincidence. I don't know. You know, Nick Spencer is a good writer. Mm-hmm. It could be that, you know, this was something that was percolating inside his brain for a while, and it just happened that a few things that were similar were coming out at the same time. Maybe he saw the Cartoon Network is picking up this thing. Hey, maybe there's, you know, that shows there's a market for this sort of thing.
And also sometimes these stories are like popular zeitgeist, like everyone just sort of has similar, like, just elements.
I'm not worried about it because, you know, actually I heard there were at least two other series, young adult series that were somewhat similar. There was like one about a school for villains, and there was something in England called The Hive, which was like a book series that's just over there that I, you know, but somebody I read on a blog right around the time of Tower Prep's premiere is like, this is The Hive, and I thought, what's The Hive about? And it's like kids at a mysterious school being trained to be villains, which was not Tower Prep, you know, but once you hear about kids trapped in a mysterious school, you know, it's like, okay, well, you know, it's similar stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Tower Prep came out of my boarding school experiences where I was, you know, pretty much literally packed up, shipped off to boarding school in this, you know, kind of foggy forest surrounding where it was sort of hard to be there, you know, and not know anybody and come into the situation. And, you know, I basically took that and did a kind of a caricature of it. And that's, and you know, but a lot of that is my high school. I mean, you run over to the cliffs, there's the ocean. Where I went, it was right next to the ocean.
Yeah.
There was a big forest around it, and we had a, there was a fraternal organization called the Gnomes, whose job was to police the other kids. You know, they didn't wear costumes or anything.
No, no, but that's still...
It was just sort of like, you know, like a little fraternity, you know, and I just, you know, borrowed the name and used it. You know, so that's the way it worked out. So this was something that was percolating in my head for a long time. Actually, I hoped that it would have been more farther from reality in the final realization of the show because, you know, in my naivety, I said, it's Cartoon Network. Wouldn't it be great to get some cartoonists I know who work over there on staff involved in this? Because I was thinking, like, well, that was the magic of Walt Disney. Is he had a whole staff of people there. And even though he was doing like shows like Zorro and The Scarecrow of Romney Marsh and Davy Crockett and stuff, he worked with a lot of the animators to create that very distinctive visual feel. So you would have little bits in Davy Crockett where you'd see like an old map and you just knew it was rendered by his matte painters or his animators or something. Or... the Ellenshaw father and son, they would do very elegant matte paintings that gave it a very distinctive look. And they also, you know, worked on every aspect of Disney product in the parks and everything. And I thought, you know, boy, there are artists I know on staff. Is there a way to have them do some freelancing, pay them a little extra, and get some of that same feel here? And from the word go, it was like, these guys are working for X amount of money on this project. You can't have them do this. And I said, well, isn't there a little bit of money in the budget to have them do some really cool uniform designs or have them design the gnomes or something like that? It's like, God, what planet are you on? We can't do that. You know how much money internally that's going to cost with bookkeeping? And so it's like, you know, I understand, you know,
how
really
corporatized everything has become.
Yeah, it's set up so it can't be creative. You can't maximize your people. Well,
it sounds a lot like my CalArts experience too, because that school, again, Disney, sort of brought together so all these different schools can come in and work together, but by the time I got there, it was like, you want to go over to that school and work with them? You can't. You're in this school. You can't go over there. You can't even take classes over there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that it really is a deterrent toward creativity, and that's something I've kind of fought against my whole life. I mean, you know, it's you grow up watching guys like Walt Disney or even, you know, Hanna and Barbera. They could maximize what their people were doing on staff to create an overall feel toward their work. And now, you know, you could hire the most brilliant guy who knows everything about Looney Tunes to come in and write a Looney Tune for you at Warner Brothers, but if you want to bring some of what that guy has and put it on a superhero show, you just can't do it. You know, it's just like, no, we pay this guy X amount of money to do this thing, and that's all he does. So it's like, okay, you know, that keeps the books clean, but you know, you got to look at what really endures, and like Disney organization has endured for, you know, 85 years or something off of their quality, and yeah. So it's sad that feeling of collaboration didn't exist when I was doing Tower Prep, even in a small way, because there were artists who would have done phenomenal, you know, uniform designs and building designs and stuff like that. You know, let's take it. You know, I know it's live action, but let's kick it up a little bit.
Spice it up.
You know, I was happy with what we got. You know, ultimately, Terry McDonough and I designed the gnomes. We just sat here on my desk on 4th of July and just came up and did the whole drawings ourselves.
Yeah, and I have a complete season on iTunes that I bought from the iTunes store, so that's I can watch it whenever I want.
I know people have emailed me and said, well, there is a DVD set. And I said, yeah, well, that's a pirate set if you want to do it.
Yeah, again, buy it on iTunes store because that does, I believe, contribute to any decisions made for DVDs, but if they're resisting to the DVD idea in general, that might not be so. But
I don't know. I'm just glad you can find it somewhere because there's no telling when they're going to yank it off of iTunes. It is still there?
Yeah, it's still there.
Okay, well, that's good. I think that about wraps it up for this time. Misty, do you have anything else you'd like to bring in or say or any news?
No, just you're singing tonight. Cress. Yeah, I have a show tonight, but nobody cares about that. It'll be over by the time I hear this.
I care.
Well, thank you. But I appreciate that, and I know you do, but by the time this airs, it will have been 2 days over. So So wish me luck in retrospect, I guess, question mark.
That's right. Oh, well, you were starting new Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Mm-hmm. No, they're not cool. New. I'm just actually actively starting to market.
Oh, right.
I'm actually finally getting to work after all these years because I know what I'm selling.
Yeah.
You know, so there's been some exciting strides and things happening that way.
Right.
Which are cool, but it's really nothing to talk about until it, you know, until later when projects get announced and, you know, things like that.
Yeah, that's why I was so quiet about the Tower Prep stuff. I didn't want to talk about anything until until we had news or something. And still don't really have any news. Still don't have the definite thumbs up, thumbs down, but, you know.
Yeah, you're on the bubble.
You're on the bubble.
You know, so you just kind of dance on the bubble and go, yeah, well, here we are on the bubble.
Yeah.
You know, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, as the background noises increase, I invite everyone to check us out on Twitters and Facebooks and all our websites and ventures. Leave us some iTunes reviews.
What did Rashi do with Hobart?
I don't know.
If they're in the barn, I hope Hobart eats some of those rats out there.
Yeah, yeah, that's really nasty, that whole thing. I don't really want to talk about the rats.
I don't know why he attacks neighbors and he won't eat the rats out of our barn.
Yeah, I guess he makes friends with them or something.
Or maybe they have to be kangaroo rats or something. Something closer to a marsupial.
I just haven't a clue.
Yeah.
All right, well, have a great week, everybody, and we'll see you around here around this time next week.
Bye.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes Store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.